In 1977, beautiful young heiress Janie Shepherd disappears from the streets of London, England.
It's just the most terrible feeling. And I wouldn't want it to happen to anyone else.
10 weeks later, Janie's mutilated body is found, dumped in a field outside the city. Janie's mother, Angela, fights for 13 years to bring the killer to trial. But a conviction hinges on testimony from an informant with his own violent criminal past.
If the jury had said not guilty, somebody was going to die out there, presumably a young blonde.
Will justice ever be served in the case of Janie Shepherd? On February the 4th, 1977, bubbly 24-year-old Janie Shepherd bounces into the house she shares with her cousins, excited about the weekend she is about to spend with her boyfriend.
She'd gone upstairs to change and wash her hair and get ready for going out in the evening. She came dashing downstairs, late, and said, "I must rush and I have to pick up some food before getting to Roddy's flat," and said, "Right, I'm off."
Janie Shepherd never arrived at her boyfriend Roddy Kinkead Weeks's flat.
After some time, I started ringing around as many hospitals and police stations as I could think of that would be relevant given the likely route that she would have taken. When she hadn't arrived by about 12 o'clock, it was obviously, not necessarily obviously, something more serious, but at that stage we were convinced that something had happened, although obviously we didn't know what.
Police initially think Janie may have been kidnapped because her stepfather is the wealthy chairman of BP, British Petroleum, in Australia. But when Janie's mud-splattered car turns up in Notting Hill, West London, it's obvious something much more serious has happened. The car has been the scene of a titanic struggle. There are traces of blood, and two ominous knife slashes mark the roof. The police suspect a violent, sexually motivated attack.
When they saw the car, because of the state of the interior, they believe they had a murder inquiry.
Detective Chief Superintendent Henry Mooney heads up the case. He makes a nationwide appeal for information.
I believe that on the night of 4th of February, when she was in her car, she was approached by a stranger who probably forced her to drive him away, or he drove her away. I believe he has killed her and has dumped her body out in the country.
Henry Mooney submits the car for forensic analysis and widens the search for Janie to places with soil that match the car's mud splatter.
I want to find a man who, on that night or the next day, was seen with a lot of light mud on his clothing or his shoes. I want information regarding any man who perhaps was missing from his usual haunts that night, who was perhaps agitated the next day, or has passed some comment regarding the disappearance of Janie Shepherd, which is out of character.
Janie's mother, Angela, and stepfather, John Darling, join the search.
We want to find Jane, desperately. We also want to help the police find Jane, to find the person that did it, so that he cannot repeat it.
We just hope that somebody has seen her somewhere, or seen something that's going to help, because otherwise it's just the most terrible feeling.
Over 50 officers scour the countryside looking for Janie, but find nothing. Henry Mooney tries a different approach. He starts going through old police files, searching for a perpetrator with the same MO.
What Henry Mooney did, he asked for all the files in relation to similar offences with this particular method of approaching females in cars and then abducting and raping them.
I think that's an interesting thing.
This one piece will make 52 layers.
Watch on mobile devices or the big screen, all for free. No subscription required.
After searching all the relevant criminal method files, Mooney emerges from his office with the name of 37-year-old car sprayer David Lashley.
He came out of his office with the file of Lashley in his hand and said, "This is the man we want."
David Lashley is well known to police. He's a serial sex offender, dubbed the Beast of Notting Hill, who has served time for raping 5 women in West London. But at the moment, he's out on parole.
He had received a 12-year sentence for a series of rapes, all following the same modus operandi. He would jump in the passenger seat of a car driven very often by a blonde white woman, produce a knife and direct her to go to a quiet place where he would rape her.
What's more, while trawling through old files, Mooney finds an attempted murder case with a striking similarity to the suspected abduction of Janie Shepherd. Just 8 months ago, the victim, known as Miss A, had been attacked in her car less than a kilometre from where Janie's car had been found in Notting Hill. And the assailant had also used a knife.
Miss A was in her car. A man tapped on her window and pointed to his wrist to ask as if he wanted to know what the time was. She either wound down her window or opened her door to tell him, and a knife was put straight at her and she was made to move across.
Miss A was driven to a quiet street, raped, dressed again, then raped a second time.
After he had done that, his words to her was, "I've got to kill you so you can't identify me."
The attacker very nearly succeeded in carrying out his threat.
I was an investigating officer for 12 years. I've never read a statement like the statement that I read that she made. She was subjected to the most horrific attack. Had she not been a diver and used to holding her breath, he would no doubt have suffocated her. Having failed to break her neck or suffocate her, he resorted to trying to cut her wrists, and he cut them incredibly deep and left her for dead.
Miraculously, Miss A survived. Instinctively, Chief Superintendent Mooney linked Miss A's case to David Lashley. And sure enough, Miss A picked Lashley out in a lineup. In February 1977, only a few weeks after Janie's disappearance, Lashley was taken into custody for the attack on Miss A. At trial, he's found guilty of rape and attempted murder and sentenced to 18 years. Miss A's case proves that Lashley had graduated from rapist to a potential murderer. But once back in prison, he refuses to answer any questions about the suspected abduction of Janie Shepherd.
If someone doesn't wish to be interviewed and they're in prison, you can have an interview, but if they say nothing, then you can't force them to speak.
As police continue to search for the young heiress, no new suspects emerge. Then on April the 17th, 2 months after Lashley's arrest, Janie's body is discovered 60 kilometres outside London, in an area known as No Man's Land Common. It's a location David Lashley visited frequently.
The relevance of No Man's Land Common is that Lashley used to go with his wife and visit his sons. They used to take those boys on No Man's Land Common to play cricket. He even tried to teach his wife to drive in a place called Devil's Dyke, which is adjacent to No Man's Land Common, which took him to the area where the body was.
But despite this latest connection, police still don't have enough to charge Lashley with Janie's murder. In 1977, there was no DNA analysis to compare Lashley's DNA to traces found in Janie's car. So all the evidence is circumstantial. The case goes cold. 11 years later, in June 1988, 8 months before Lashley's parole date, Janie's mother, Angela, writes to the Hertfordshire Police asking about the status of her daughter's case. Her letter triggers a reinvestigation.
Well, Lashley was a suspect in the earlier investigation, but when I was given the brief, I very carefully decided to keep an open mind. As an investigating officer, one has to do that.
Detective Chief Inspector Ian Winnett and his team review Janie Shepherd's case file, but generate no new leads. They check up on Lashley in Frankland Prison in Durham, northeast England, where he's finishing his sentence for the rape and attempted murder of Miss A. They talk to prison guards, but hear nothing to raise suspicions. Then suddenly, they get an incredible break.
4 months after I had visited Franklin Prison, I received a phone call from the security officers I'd met there, telling me that an inmate had come forward to a prison officer saying that Lashley had given great detail as to how he had murdered Janie Shepherd.
The inmate in Franklin is nervous to turn informant, but he's willing to make a statement.
I think the inmate came forward because he was horrified when he was told of the circumstances of the murder, and that he had a wife and a daughter, and no matter what his background was, he felt he was doing the community, everybody, a favour by protecting them from this individual who he felt certain would go out and kill somebody else.
Statements from inmate informers have to be handled extremely carefully. Juries can be wary of believing the word of a convict, and inmates have plenty of reasons to lie in exchange for reduced sentences or special privileges. An experienced officer, unfamiliar with the Janie Shepherd case, is sent to meet the informant.
It is essential that the officer taking the statement had no knowledge of the case or how the murder was committed, to avoid at trial the allegation that the evidence had been fed to the inmate.
The statement the officer brings back to St Albans Police is remarkable.
It was in such detail, and it contained facts which had never been put into the media. Only the person who had killed Janie would know the detail.
Armed with the informant's testimony, police finally have enough to charge David Lashley with the murder of Janie Shepherd. They plan to arrest Lashley as soon as he leaves Frankland Prison. Due to a quirk of English law, he can't be arrested inside. He must walk through the prison gates. Lashley is still considered Category A, the most dangerous type of prisoner, and has a reputation for being extraordinarily strong. So police can't afford to take any chances.
At that time in Hertfordshire, we had what were called divisional, like tactical units, uniformed officers. which was like a sergeant and say six men. So we used the divisional tactical unit, and we had a Durham police dog handler and also a Durham police traffic car. And that was in case we were followed from the prison once we had arrested them.
Lashley only walks free for about 30 seconds.
And he was then arrested and put into a large van with handcuffed to our largest officer and conveyed with several stops, because it's quite a long journey, down to St Albans.
On February the 17th, 1990, 13 years after Jenny Shepherd was murdered, David Lashley arrives at St Albans Crown Court. To ensure he gets a fair trial, the jury will not be told the nature of his past crimes.
Lashley had an appalling record, but only a very small portion of that was known to the jury. Obviously, rules prevent bad character generally being put before a jury.
Despite the lack of information about Lashley's past, those in attendance in the courtroom can't fail to be affected by his appearance.
You're immediately struck by, I suppose, the size of the man and the power he seemed to possess. He looked extremely strong. Not the tallest of men, but you got the feeling that there was an immense strength and very, very calm and almost relaxed.
But Janie Shepherd's mother, Angela, is not intimidated by the man she believes killed her daughter. She is the first witness called by the prosecution.
She wanted to give evidence in the witness box, and her evidence, in fact, was relatively formal. What she was able to do was to identify her daughter's body by reference to a ring that her daughter was wearing.
Next, details of Janie's autopsy are presented to the court. She was not strangled, but died from compression of the neck. Her throat had been crushed. Photographs of the interior of Janie's car are also presented as evidence. The prosecution highlights the seat belts. They had been half cut with a knife, then manually ripped through.
No one with ordinary strength could have done that. They did tests, enormous tests, to try and see what strength a person would need to pull the rest of the seatbelt to break it. And normal strength wouldn't cover it.
Lashley's strength is obvious just by looking at him. But he'd also kept records of the weights he'd lifted in the prison gym.
They were huge weights. In fact, it was said that some of those weights were actually greater than Olympic records. And so we had an expert to say that it could be done, but only by somebody who had the sort of strength that would enable them to lift the sort of weights that Lashley was capable of lifting.
The prosecution are ready to call their star witness, the prison informer. Daniel Rees takes the stand.
Daniel Rees was brought in by an usher to begin with, who pulled aside velvet curtains, and the door frame was exposed, and in came this man who barely fitted through the door. He was that enormous, and his record spoke for itself. He was a very, very dangerous man. He was no gentle giant, this one.
Rees and Lashley lifted weights together in prison and used to be friends. The prosecution starts going through Rees's statement.
Rees was able to tell the jury that in this confession, Lashley had told him how, on the night Janie disappeared, he was in the Queensway area of Bayswater. And his words to Rees were that he'd seen a nice-looking girl going into a shop.
Rees testifies that Lashley told him he spotted the for sale sign in Janie's Mini and waited by her car.
Lashley's account to Rees was that he'd engaged her in conversation about the car, and then suddenly produced a knife and bundled Janie into the vehicle.
Rhys gave a broad description of Lashley forcing the girl to take him at knife point. And the point about the knife was that he used it to slash the material on the inside of the roof, just to prove how sharp his knife was. And again, that's a detail that nobody outside the investigators themselves would have known.
Rhys then states that Lashley forced Janie to drive to a quiet part of West London.
He then raped her, and it was as he raped her that he killed her. And he gave Rhys a demonstration of the way he did it. He put his left hand round the back of Rhys's neck, and then he pushed the knuckle part of his fist into Rhys's throat, the front area of the neck, and that was the way Lashley described that he had killed Janie, that she was choking, and she'd died.
Rhys's graphic description explains the mystery of how Janie died from compression of the neck.
His account went on that he redressed her, not in the clothes that he'd taken from her, because they were ripped to smithereens, but he'd dressed her in a change of clothing that Janie had with her that night, and then strapped her into the car and driven out of London.
According to Rhys, Lashley told him that he dumped Janie's body at a Lover's Lane area, a match to No Man's Land Common. And when Janie was found, she was indeed wearing the clothes from her overnight bag.
He made the point as well that Janie had been swaying from side to side in the car as they drove out, which he found amusing and laughed.
Rhys's testimony stuns the court. It fits every single piece of evidence the jury have heard so far. His story is compelling, but Rhys still has to be cross-examined by Lashley's barrister. She tries to discredit him by alluding to his own bad character and criminal past. Finally, after his anger builds to boiling point, Rhys explodes at Lashley.
I remember one particular exchange where Rhys turned to face Lashley, who was over feet away sitting in the dock, and he said, bearing in mind he was shouting it more than saying it, "What I've said in this court is the truth. He's an animal, he's a killer, and he enjoyed killing Janie Shepherd. That's why he spoke about it to me, because he relived it."
The problem always when you're prosecuting a case that depends very heavily on a criminal with a terrible record, as Rhys had, is that a jury is naturally reluctant to rely on such a person's word. And whilst it's possible to bring a case simply based on a person like that's word, it's very difficult.
After the prosecution rests, it's the defence's turn to call their star witness. David Lashley's aunt and alibi, Mrs. Erthra Smith. She testifies under oath that Lashley was at her house, in bed, on the night Janie died. She says she looked in his room and saw him. During cross-examination, the prosecution questions Mrs. Smith about the evidence she gave at the trial of Miss A, who Lashley raped and attempted to murder just before Janie Shepherd disappeared.
When the alibi evidence was given by his aunt, it was identical to the alibi evidence that was given in 1977 at the trial of Miss A. Identical evidence.
The jury are left to make up their own minds as to whether Erthra Smith was telling the truth. If they believe her over Daniel Rees, they will find in Lashley's favour. Almost 6 weeks after the trial began, the jury are sent out to deliberate their verdict.
While the jury was out, there was a very curious feeling, actually. If Lashley had walked out of that court on a not guilty verdict, there is nothing in this world more certain than that he would have done it again. He had a record which showed that he would do this. He was extremely dangerous. And so it's on a knife edge in one sense. If the jury had said not guilty, somebody was going to die out there, presumably a young blonde.
It takes just 2.25 hours for the jury to return. They find David Lashley guilty of the rape and murder of Janie Shepherd. Outside the courthouse, Janie's family remains calm and dignified, just as they had during the entire 13-year investigation and trial.
I think it's absolutely marvellous that justice has been done.
She took me by the arm and she just said, "Thanks, Mick." And that meant everything to me. And it still does.
Well, justice was done in the sense that he was convicted and sentenced to life. Justice could be slightly undone if he was ever let out. He must never be let out, this man. He must never, ever be let out.
Through the guardrail, down the embankment.
Renette Riella Bergner dies, but her husband escapes with barely a scratch.
It was hard for me to believe that my sister and him were both in the vehicle and he didn't wind up the same way she did.
This is no accident.
Murder was perfect for him. It was the cheaper way out.
But proving this man is a killer may be impossible.
This was a viciously fought battle.
This is the story of a mysterious death, a courtroom drama, and a jury that could go either way.
I thought we had a chance. I really did. But I also felt we had a chance that we were going to lose.
Incline Village, Nevada is a prosperous town on the shores of Lake Tahoe, the famous resort straddling the California-Nevada border.
Incline Village is a small city that's up at the lake, Lake Tahoe. Everybody knows everybody. It's a beautiful town. It's a beautiful area to live.
45-year-old Peter Bergner and his wife Renette, aged 49, are a fixture of the local community.
My sister was a pharmacist. She was a very outgoing, bubbly person, very positive person. She did not dwell on the negative. When she became your friend, she was friends for decades. She just saw good in everybody.
Peter Bergner works out of the couple's comfortable home in Incline Village. He is an appraiser for Butterfield and Butterfield, a respected San Francisco auction house.
He dealt with collectibles, antiques, and stuff like that. And he bought and sold them. And he was very good at his job. He knew his stuff.
With a large income and no kids, the Bergners spend much of their time indulging Renette's passion, European travel. In 1998, Renette decides to turn her hobby into a full-time career. She quits her job as a pharmacist to become a tour guide. From now on, she'll be spending weeks at a time away from Peter, and her income will be dramatically reduced.
Well, he didn't like it. It wasn't that she was making minimum wage, but she just wasn't making the money that she was being a pharmacist.
On the evening of May the 31st, 1998, Renette lands in Reno after her first guiding trip to Italy. She's been traveling for nearly 24 hours. But instead of driving her home, Bergner insists they go straight to a remote hillside overlooking the lights of the city.
It's actually a very nice place. It overlooks the entire valley. There's a very steep embankment, large cliff and whatnot.
When they reach the lookout spot, they talk for an hour and a half and then decide to head for home. As Bergner's truck heads back towards the main road, something goes horribly wrong.
The vehicle went through the guardrail, down the embankment, and traveled some 800 plus feet down the hillside.
Somehow, Bergner survives the crash and calls 911. Highway patrolman John Schilling responds and is the first person to arrive at the crash site.
When I arrived on the scene, Peter was found approximately 100 feet down the hillside from the roadway. Renette, we ultimately made it down to the vehicle and she was inside the vehicle. For the pickup truck to travel from the roadway down to the hillside only took a very short period of time. And so, yes, I think that Renette passed away quite quickly.
When daylight breaks, the horrific nature of the crash and the scale of the drop becomes clear. Bergner's survival seems nothing short of miraculous.
I had just got to work, and my brother called me and told me that we had lost our sister in a car wreck.
While the wreckage is recovered from the mountain, Bergner is taken to the local sheriff's station for a routine debriefing.
And I accelerate down the hill. And then I start saying, Renette, we're not stopping. We're not stopping.
Wait. The memory won't stop. I don't know why it won't stop. My eyes, the memory won't stop.
Sheriff's deputies are curious about how Bergner managed to escape from the truck with nothing more than a sprained ankle and a bruise on his head. But he becomes strangely defensive when they question him about it.
Somehow you got out of the truck.
Somehow I got out of the truck.
Can we properly assume that you were still in the truck when you were through the garden?
Assume anything you want. I can't help you here. I can't help you.
When I've gone to a scene where people have been ejected or thrown out of a vehicle, usually they're a little more disturbed in their clothing, their appearance. Peter, when he was laying on the side of the hill, it looked like he had just basically laid down.
In the weeks following the crash, police begin to wonder how accidental it really was. They bring all their evidence to the district attorney's office for a second opinion.
Things were not adding up. This was an individual who was allegedly ejected from a vehicle who hardly had any injuries on him.
He filled up additional fuel cans that were in the back of his pickup truck. And when you closely examine those, there was an open hole for the fuel to spill.
It could have been a simple oversight, or it could mean Bergner wanted the truck to catch fire.
Peter Bergner's 911 call, he says, I woke up looking for a fire. And in the movies, that would have happened, but in real life, it doesn't.
Suspicion of Bergner grows still further when police review his interviews from the immediate aftermath of the crash.
There were a host of things that Peter said in there that were questionable at best.
I'm hitting the brakes. We're not stopping.
If there's some sort of brake failure, there's got to be a reason for it.
I never said there was brake failure. I think my brakes worked just fine.
He got caught either embellishing, lying, whatever you would like to attach to it, but had to backtrack and cover some of the issues to kind of throw people off the trail.
For me, there was a huge lie right in the middle of Peter Bergner's 911 call. He tells the responders, come get me. I'm right below the guardrail. It's open like a gate. Where he was found, you couldn't see that in the daylight, let alone at night. So that told me, without question, that he came through the opening of the gate after and had slid down.
As investigators probe deeper into Bergner's background, they discover he wasn't the loving husband he appeared to be.
There was times I thought he verbally abused her in front of everybody, and I didn't think that was necessary.
The night before he picked up Burnett from the airport, he was out flirting with women, drinking with women. Then right after the incident, he was groping women in a hot tub.
They also learn that despite Bergner's bad behavior, Renette was not about to let him walk out of their 11-year marriage.
Renette was a staunch Catholic who did not believe in divorce. So it's our belief, and I think her family would attest to this as well, that she had no intention of divorcing him.
However, upon Renette's death, Bergner cashed in a handsome life insurance policy and collected a large share of his wife's family estate. He inherits more than $750,000. But despite having motive and opportunity, it is still possible that the crash is simply what Bergner claims, a tragic and inexplicable accident.
At first I thought, you know, that maybe they got in an argument and he gunned it. At least I would have had some kind of peace of mind of what the reasoning was behind it. But whatever he was saying didn't fit what happened. And it just didn't add up. Just didn't add up.
In early 1999, Bergner sells the house he shared with Renette and moves to Seattle, Washington, where he becomes engaged to a new woman. But the case remains open, and John Schilling in particular is determined to learn the truth about what happened on the mountainside. Even in his spare time, he keeps working on the investigation.
We did some testing. We actually acquired a Ford F-150 that was extremely close to Mr. Bergner's vehicle.
Vehicle's in drive. No emergency, the emergency brake is on. Trooper Schilling's on the side here.
Schilling, an experienced accident investigator, finds a huge flaw in Bergner's account of how the crash occurred.
I placed the vehicle in numerous practice runs up there in which we would take the vehicle and allow it to, under its own power, go down the roadway.
What's our speed, right? We're 17, 18, 19, 20.
According to Bergner, his truck wasn't going much faster than 20 miles per hour. But by the time it reached the point of impact, marked here with an X, he could not prevent it crashing through the guardrail. When Schilling tries to recreate the crash, he discovers that Bergner is lying. No vehicle driving normally down this road could ever end up crashing through the guardrail at that point.
There we go. Show where the impactor was at over there.
Unless it is intentionally driven off the cliff.
It was definitely determined that if the vehicle was let go down the road, that it would never make it to the guardrail.
He concludes that Bergner must have deliberately rammed his truck into the guardrail at high speed. He also has a theory about why Bergner was so lightly injured. He jumped out before the truck left the road.
When I first got onto the scene, one of the first things I noticed as I got out of my car was there was a ball cap that was laying up on the road edge. Later on, we did an examination of the clothing that Mr. Bergner was wearing, and in several areas on his clothing were deposits of asphalt. For Mr. Bergner to be ejected after going through the guardrail is not a possibility. He came out on the roadway, and that's how the asphalt was deposited on his clothes.
All the evidence seems to point to one conclusion.
Once you take all of these items and you place them together, that's when we determined that this wasn't an accident, that it was a homicide and a planned event.
It's a highly circumstantial case. No single piece of evidence by itself is enough to secure a conviction. But in November 2000, lead prosecutor Dave Clifton persuades a grand jury there is enough to indict Peter Bergner for first-degree murder. Sergeant Schilling is dispatched to Seattle to arrest him.
I knocked on the door, and he opened it, and he saw me. And I said, I think you know why we're here. And he kind of just shook his head. And it was quite interesting to be the one to put the handcuffs on him and take him to jail.
We were happy. I mean, we figured finally to get a chance at some justice here, you know, in this deal.
On October the 1st, 2001, more than 3 years after the crash that killed Renette, Peter Bergner stands trial for her murder. Vowing to fight the charges all the way, Bergner retains a top-flight legal team, led by a combative Seattle lawyer named Michael Schwartz.
He hired two former prosecutors out of the state of Washington. So it was prosecutors against prosecutors, and they were incredible attorneys. They put on their own version of the case and tried to convince the jury that this was an accident, that this is a way overblown prosecution, and this poor man needs to be set free.
In his opening argument, Schwartz presents his own theory of how the crash occurred.
They presented an animation to the jury. They basically began Peter and Renette's pickup truck traveling down the roadway right next to the guardrail. And then once the vehicle comes in contact with the guardrail, it all but stops its forward motion, rotates around its axis clockwise, pointing down the hill, and then again continues forward in that different direction. And as I was viewing it, I don't know how these people that were working for the defense team felt in any way, shape, or form that this was a professional model.
Though it looks like nonsense to Schilling, the laypeople of the jury might just think it plausible enough to find reasonable doubt. It's a daring and effective strategy.
This was a viciously fought battle, probably the hardest defense team I'd ever been up against, and it was really, you know, a very big challenge going against them.
To make sure the jury believes his version of events, Michael Schwartz tries to discredit Sergeant Schilling and all his work on the investigation.
4 or 5 days I was on the stand. The biggest thing that they came after was the fact that they said that I was not a college-educated individual when it came to physics. And that they just believe that, hey, I'm just a police officer, I should be out writing speeding tickets and taking people to jail who've been drinking too much.
In fact, John Schilling is one of Nevada's most experienced accident reconstructionists. Using the prosecution's own animation and a detailed model of the crash site, he fights back from the witness stand.
I've done several hundreds into the thousands of accidents. There's no way that that animation is in any way, shape, or form going to represent what occurred on the hillside that night.
The Riella family, desperate to learn the truth, are in court for every moment of the trial.
Some days you're really feeling like, boy, we got something accomplished. And other days, it just seemed like, boy, they're going to blow this out of the water. But you got to see what the defense can do. They don't have to tell the truth. I realize there's a justice system that operates a certain way, but to me, it's not right.
Over 6 grueling weeks, the prosecution presents each piece of the complex puzzle while the defense tries to show that none of it adds up to a deliberate homicide. To finish their case, the prosecution turns to the character of Bergner. They must prove he is a man capable of killing his wife.
We called Peter Bergner's neighbor, who saw him pelting Renette with a snowblower and being horrible to her in their neighborhood. We called former employees who had seen him being a person who was screaming and yelling and exploding like a volcano. We brought in the women who he had hit on prior to Renette being murdered and just right after her murder. He killed his wife so that he could not be married to her. It was literally that simple.
On November the 13th, the jury retires to decide, was this an accident or a murder?
when you prosecute a case, as long as you know you've done your best, it is what it is. Now, that said, it's still a very stressful time, because especially in a case of this magnitude where you've spent weeks and weeks in trial, thousands of hours of preparation and investigation, and you've got a family who wants justice served for their loved one.
I thought we had a chance. I really did. But I also felt we had a chance that we were going to lose. To put it on odds, it was, I would say, around that 50-50 mark, to be perfectly honest.
For 3 days, nothing is heard from the jury. Then on day four, they inform the judge they cannot reach a unanimous verdict. He implores them to keep trying.
Time didn't move too fast. You know, it's not an easy thing to go through, that, you know. Whether you're up there or back at home, you're just waiting.
On day six, Judge Brent Adams polls the jury once again. They are permanently deadlocked.
There was 9 for guilty and 3 for not guilty.
Judge Adams called everybody back, and the jury could not come to a unanimous decision, and it was a hung jury.
A mistrial is declared, and Peter Bergner is set free. It's a crushing blow to Renette's family. Prosecutors Dave Clifton and Kelly Valoria are equally upset.
At the time, I was exhausted. That was mentally, physically, every type of way exhausted. But it wasn't about me. And, you know, Dave, we felt we had done everything we could do.
We definitely weren't happy about it. I mean, and then there was a question of whether they try it again. Dave and Kelly did a heck of a job. And they put their heart and soul into it. And then Dave especially was just, you know, devastated that, and he didn't think he could do it again.
Setting their disappointment aside, the prosecution carefully assesses their chances of securing a guilty verdict with a second try.
It was up to us to decide what we're going to do, whether or not this is a case for retrial. You need to remember, after spending nearly 8 weeks in court and a tremendous cost to the taxpayers of Washoe County, that's not something that we take lightly. With the caveat, this is a murder case, and we don't want murderers walking out on our street for the safety of the community.
Their decision hangs on whether or not they believe they can ever persuade a jury to convict Bergner unanimously.
It was 9-3, and they say on a 11-1 or 10-2, you pretty well go, but 9-3, sometimes you don't.
When Valoria interviews the jury, she discovers some of them fail to do their legal duty. They are required to discuss all the evidence before reaching a verdict. But 3 decided, in advance, that Peter Bergner was innocent. Then for 6 days, they stonewalled the other jurors.
They made a decision at the very beginning that they knew what their verdict was going to be. They were not going to participate in discussing it with anybody. That's juror misconduct.
I just was like, I think we got a little bit more work, because I knew that based upon what we had here, that we were going to end up going back to trial.
1 week after the mistrial, District Attorney Richard Gamick announces his decision.
We will go back to trial on Peter Bergner for the charge of murder.
May 6th, 2002. The parties return to court to try Bergner for murder all over again. Prosecutors Dave Clifton and Kelly Valoria re-present all the evidence from the first trial, Bergner's inconsistent statements, the gas cans, the asphalt marks, and John Schilling's testimony that this was no accident. They also have one new witness. It turns out Bergner had been married before he met Renette. His first wife, Rebecca Tillery, is brought to Reno and testifies that in private, Bergner was an abusive and terrifying man. Throughout their 3-year marriage, she lived in fear of him.
She made an impact. She just described what it was like to live behind closed doors as the wife of this man. You know, there was a side that everybody else got to see, and then there was a side the wives got to see. And it allowed Renette to be heard in the courtroom. It was powerful evidence.
Once again, the case goes to the jury, and once again, the wait for a verdict is agonizing.
It had gone by for days there, and we didn't have any word other than they were still deliberating.
It was a little frustrating because I want to say that the jury, we finished the case at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon Friday, and the judge sent them home at 5. So we had to sit around and wait all weekend. They did not reconvene to deliberate until Monday, and that was a little uncomfortable, but they came back fairly quickly after that weekend break.
When I heard that the jury had made a decision, kind of nervous at first because you don't really get that, I don't know, sigh of relief until you finally hear those words.
The first one we heard from was actually a juror from the first trial that followed it. And she called and she called and asked for me. I couldn't take the call. She said they found him guilty. And I'll tell you, you know, they talk about like a weight going off your chest. It did. That's the only time I've ever felt like that.
Bergner is sentenced to life in prison. He will be eligible for parole in the year 2022.
We became very close with the Riella family during this trial. They're just amazing people who did not deserve this. They opened their home to Peter Bergner and loved him, even though they didn't like him, because their sister loved him. And it was just nice to see justice served for them.
Bergner has made numerous appeals. So far, all have failed. The Riella family is eternally grateful to everyone who persevered to find the truth and get justice for Renette.
I think the best way to say it, they allowed Renette to be part of their family. They felt a personal connection to her. You have to make her a person, not just a pickup going over the side. That was your sister going over the side. I think they got my sister into that courtroom.